the matter of State versus Luis Melendez. May we please have appearances of counsel? Welcome, counsel. Please be seated. Ms. Lasota, go ahead.
Your Honors, may it please the court. I respectfully request 2 minutes of rebuttal time, only if necessary.
That's fine.
When Mr. Melendez was arrested, he made no statements about any of the evidence, including $2,900 that had been seized by police during the execution of a search warrant. While incarcerated pretrial and represented by the Office of the Public Defender in his criminal case, the state served Mr. Melendez with a civil forfeiture complaint for the $2,900 seized. The tax summons advised Mr. Melendez that he had only 35 days to answer or his property would be forfeited. That summons also contained misinformation about his ability to obtain representation in the forfeiture matter, and most importantly, did not include any information whatsoever as to how that his answer could be used against him in his criminal trial. Mr. Melendez, who was forced to act pro se in the forfeiture matter, filed an uncounseled post-indictment answer to the state's forfeiture complaint, alleging that the $2,900 seized was his property and was the lawful proceeds of a government-issued check. The state then admitted that answer as evidence of guilt at his criminal trial to establish that he had admitted to ownership of an item found in the same room as other incriminating evidence, an admission that Mr. Melendez never made when he was arrested. Your Honors, the procedure used by the state here to elicit Mr. Melendez's incriminating statement through the forfeiture proceeding and use it as evidence of guilt against him at his criminal trial violated several of his constitutional rights. First, the procedure required him to choose to his detriment between two of his rights, his Fifth Amendment right to remain silent in the criminal case and his 14th Amendment right to due process in the civil forfeiture matter. Second, Mr. Melendez's waiver of his Fifth Amendment right to remain silent was not knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently made, as he was not provided with Miranda warnings prior to that waiver, and even if those warnings were not required, his answer was the product of official compulsion that deprived him of the free choice to admit, refuse to answer, or to deny. And third, the procedure circumvented Mr. Melendez's Sixth Amendment right to counsel in his criminal case, as his answer was made post-indictment and without the knowledge and consent of defense counsel. As a result, this court should reverse Mr. Melendez's conviction and remand the matter for a new trial without admission of the forfeiture answer, as that answer was coerced. Even if these errors did not violate Mr. Melendez's constitutional rights, they violated the doctrine of fundamental fairness, as the procedure used by the state here to obtain Mr. Melendez's statement and admit it at his criminal trial was so inherently unfair. Reversal is also required, as admission of the answer was not harmless. Mr. Melendez's answer was his only statement claiming ownership to any of the items or evidence seized by police. That statement was the most compelling evidence against him and likely impacted the jury's guilty verdict. Finally, for future guidance, this court should hold that a civil forfeiture answer is inadmissible during the state's case in chief at the parallel criminal trial. Such a ruling would ensure that the constitutional conflict present in the instant case would be avoided and would allow both the civil and criminal matters to proceed simultaneously without delay. Your Honors, that concludes my opening statement.
Ms. Lasota, let's assume that you have to file an answer.
Right.
Assume it for purposes of this question. Can the answer assert the Fifth Amendment? Can the answer say, I decline to respond specifically to the allegations on grounds that might incriminate me?
Under the statute, it can't, because the statute, the civil forfeiture statute itself, and I believe it's subsection D of 64-3, says that not only does the defendant or the claimant shall file an answer, but it shall include a claim of property interest. So saying that I'm reserving my right to acknowledge that what that interest is so that I don't incriminate myself doesn't fulfill the requirements of that statute.
So you think a judge could toss that out?
Yes. Under that statute, yes.
What about a general denial?
A general denial would still not fulfill the requirements of that statute that says a property claim has to be acknowledged in the answer.
Well, it says the claimant of the property, so that's, I guess, assumed that you'd have to be claiming the property. How do you interpret F? Is an answer required before
Yes.
The need to...
The statute requires that an answer be filed first before any of the parties, including the state, request a stay.
Okay, so your position is that an answer claiming ownership to the property has to precede a motion for a stay?
Yes.
Okay, my last question on this. If that's the case, then Garrity would seem to govern the outcome, no?
Right, and that's one of my positions in this case. If Miranda warnings weren't required in the summons, then Garrity would still govern the outcome here, because this defendant is facing a situation where he has to waive his Fifth Amendment right and acknowledge possession, or he faces certain loss of his property. And that's exactly the scenario that Garrity had. And in that case, the Supreme Court of the United States noted that that is compulsion and that is a coerced statement.
Do you think that there's room in our interpretation of this statute to take an approach in the defendant's answer? This ties into the Chief's question to you. That's along the lines of our very broad standing approach that we take for Fourth Amendment issues when possession is involved. I mean, we grant defendants very broad standing authority so they can avoid the need to have a conflict among constitutional provisions. So why can't we acknowledge a more general form of answer that acknowledges, for purposes of the in rem proceeding, enough of an interest to contest the state's ability to pursue forfeiture without giving up Fifth Amendment rights?
I think in order to do that, the legislature would have to change the statute. The language of the statute makes it clear that not only does an answer have to be filed first, but it has to include that claimant's property interest. So already we have a statutory problem here.
But that language could have also been focused on third parties who might have an interest in the statute. That's a very broad reading of the legislature's intent when it used that language. Because clearly, when you look at J, the legislature was concerned about the tension between the rights of the defendant in a criminal proceeding and the ultimate use of the conclusion of a forfeiture action.
But, Your Honor, respectfully, I don't think the legislature was considering this scenario, because even in subsection F, it says stay of the proceedings, not the pleadings. So that presumes...
I'm not arguing that an answer doesn't have to be filed before a motion for a stay. I don't know how someone could claim the ability to be a move-ont in a proceeding before you've become a party to that proceeding, which to me means you have to file an answer.
Right, right.
Okay. So could we, consistent with the language of the statute, essentially adopt, perhaps by court rule, a pleading that takes away any possible dilemma on the part of the defendant?
I think that would help solve the problem. My only other concern is, especially for claimants like Mr. Melendez, who are placed in a situation where they are incarcerated, they can't obtain counsel on the civil forfeiture claim. I still think that there needs to be more, specifically in the summons, that advises them that even if the rules change what the answer has to contain, they have to be told, even if they provide a statement, that it could be possibly incriminatory in their criminal case. And I think, very importantly in this case, it didn't really matter what Mr. Melendez said with regards to where the money came from. It's the fact that he's saying, yes, it's mine, that is incriminating him. So he could have said it was a birthday present. It didn't matter. His answer says, this is mine, and that's what the state used as evidence of guilt to establish that at the criminal case, he said this money found in this room with other evidence was his, so therefore everything in this room has to be his.
You're focused on subsection D. When you talk about the obligation shall state the interest in the property by virtue of which the claimant demands its restitution and the right to defend, that's the language that you're focused on to say that the statute obliges the affirmative assertion
right.
of that interest?
Right.
Okay.
And that interplays with subsection F, which contains the stay language.
So could that provision be satisfied with a pleading in the nature of a general denial, as Justice Lubecki was suggesting, that simply states that subsection D I assert my rights pursuant to subsection D. Something that you put before a jury is not going to...
I mean, it would have to be that defendant or that claimant in that case, especially some using Mr. Melendez as an example, would have to basically say, I'm challenging this, but I'm not providing any additional information. And unless the summons directly explains that to him, I think there's a risk that these claimants, especially if they're defendants in the criminal case, are going to put forward that I own this property.
I understand your concerns with the summons, but could the legislature's language be satisfied with a general denial that does not spell out for the jury, potentially in a criminal trial, that the property is the defendant's? Or
the,
so he claims.
The way it's written, Your Honor, I submit no, because it says shall state the interest in property.
Yeah, but that, in these cases, it's not necessarily the defendant who may be the claimant. There are many cases where cars are taken. It's the parent's car. It's a friend's car. This isn't like a typical civil case where the plaintiff is named and the defendant is named. And an answer isn't required. You can make a motion, actually, to dismiss the action for the failure to state a claim.
What's named is the res, the item
that's
of the complaint.
That's the issue. Over here, there is no defendant. And that's the reason it seems to me that the statute requires that someone assert a claim so we know who is claiming to have some interest in the property. It's not necessarily the defendant. It could be any of them, with respect to this money, it could have been any of a number of other people.
Right. And I agree with you, Your Honor, and I think that's why the statute is written the way it is. If it's just a general denial, that's not stating a claim in the interest, in the property, as the statute required. That doesn't give any information to the civil court or the state saying, yes, I have an interest in this. It's just saying a general denial, I don't think really says much at all about their interest in the property.
What's your position on the recommendation of the ACLU that judges should presumptively stay these actions if there's a parallel criminal proceeding?
I think that is a good remedy. I probably just didn't think of it first when I was writing my brief.
That's usually done.
Right, and some courts or some other jurisdictions
I know some
have done that.
Civil forfeiture judges that when there's a criminal trial, you can't dismiss a complaint because the state loses control because it has to be filed within 90 days. If you dismiss a complaint, even without prejudice, that's the end of it. But I think most judges, or at least a lot of judges, I know one that always stayed everything in Camden for criminal trial to end.
Right, and I think an automatic stay would, as long as it's done pre-answer, obviously, would resolve the conflict here. My only concern is that the summons would still have to inform the claimant, especially a claimant like Mr. Melendez, who is the defendant in the criminal trial, like what that means.
Is it going to be, so here's the issue. An automatic stay in all cases, even when the defendant isn't the claimant?
Well, and that's...
because it may be the father, it may be the mother who owned the car. That is a very typical scenario. Drugs are found in a car. The parents own the car. They want the car back.
Sure, and I think that's, unfortunately, the pitfalls of an automatic stay is that it's staying all these forfeiture claims until the criminal case is over. The criminal case may take a few years. I think that's the downside. That's why the remedy I'm submitting is the same remedy that was used in Simmons, which is that it just doesn't come in as evidence in the case in chief.
Let's stay with the stay concept for just a second.
Sure.
You've jumped to automatic stay. What about presumptively staying it so that another third party could come in and persuade the judge that the case should go forward?
That could be a remedy too, Your Honor. As long as that is explained to the claimants that are receiving notice as to what is going on, what a stay means in plain language, and if in that case that's a possibility that if you are a third party that isn't affected by the criminal case, you can come in and make a claim for the property. I think there might be some situations where maybe there's a little bit of a discord between who is actually the claimant, whether it is actually the third parties or the criminal defendant, and that the civil court would have to decide whether or not to stay the matter or whether to go forward with it. But I think the remedy that I'm providing doesn't have to worry about that.
Isn't there another one? And that is, in a case like this, where the person is already represented, as he was here, he's represented
right.
from the outset of the bail hearing by the
right.
public defender's office, and where a response to the forfeiture complaint has the potential to incriminate the defendant, that automatically that complaint should be given to the criminal defense attorney, even though the criminal defense attorney may not be representing on that particular matter. He or she certainly would be in a position to advise the client whether or not an answer to the complaint would incriminate him.
I agree, Your Honor. And I think that's what the appellate division noted, that with regards to courtesy copies, this is information that the criminal defense attorney...
Why should this be a courtesy copy? This should be... Why wouldn't this be mandatory?
I agree with you, Justice Albin, that it should be mandatory. The defense attorney needs to know this information before the defendant acts on it.
I'm not sure what you're recommending. I mean, is this only in cases where the prosecutor knows there's a public defender involved? Is there a duty to... inquire? What are you suggesting?
The prosecutor's office knew Mr. Melendez was represented by my office at first appearance. They knew this matter was referred.
That's true.
I think that they should be cross-checking earlier in the process to see if there is, especially with us, we come in so early. Now with CJRA, we even come in earlier, that there is an attorney assigned and send a copy to that attorney.
Under the statute, they only have 90 days to get the complaint filed. So trying to determine, many times the individual doesn't have a defense attorney or a public defender by that point. So I don't know that one could be served. There's some other way, because without changing the statute, because 90 days is it. And that's, right in the scheme of things in criminal matter, that's a rather short period of time.
I agree it's a short period, but respectfully, I think at that point the state would know who the attorney is.
Assuming there is one.
Matter.
Many times, because you agree with many times in 90 days, there's no defense attorney. Public defender's office hasn't been involved yet.
I think under the scheme, it was clear that they were involved at his first appearance.
This particular
prior.
Case, I'm talking
right.
about in general.
I would disagree, especially now under the CJRA. Our office is coming in at first appearances to handle detention hearings. So at that point, the state knows that at least our office has represented this client there, and they can cross-check.
How about
that.
When there's a private attorney? What happens then?
At that point, I mean, yes, that would make that a little harder. I think the state has to do their due diligence to ensure that this defendant is represented, that attorney gets a copy of this forfeiture.
Well, how difficult is it? If a private attorney appears at a bail hearing or at a detention hearing or submits a letter to the court and to the prosecutor's office that he or she is representing the defendant, that doesn't pose any difficulty in terms of notice, does it?
No, absolutely not. I mean, just the cross-check of Promise Gavel would give you that information. It wouldn't take too long to figure that out.
If the public defender's office is advising a client whom the office represents in a criminal matter as to what action that client should take in a civil forfeiture matter, understanding that it has ramifications for the criminal defense, but directing that client to do something or advising that client to do something or not do something in a civil forfeiture matter, is that beyond the scope of the public defender's representation?
Absolutely not, Your Honors. I would equate this to a situation, for example, immigration. Not all OPD attorneys are immigration experts, but we still have the obligation to tell our clients how their actions in a criminal case, if they take a guilty plea or if the verdict ends up one way or another, how that's going to impact their status.
But isn't that different? Because you're not advising the client to take any action in the immigration court. My concern is this. Obviously, that's potential ramifications down the road based upon what happens in the criminal defense.
Right.
But in this situation, you may be saying, depending on how things play out, here's what you should do in the civil forfeiture. In order to, and I'm worried about, I want you to do well on your civil forfeiture defense, but I'm also concerned about the ramifications for the case that we're defending.
And, Your Honor, I think that's still within the realm of advice that we can give as an OPD attorney. We can't obviously force the defendant to choose to move for a stay or file an answer, but we can tell them what the ramifications are if they do that in their criminal
case.
Right,
and that would be the type of common thing a criminal defense attorney would do. All he would be doing is saying, that if you respond to this in that way, that's going to be used against you at the trial. You're going to be incriminating yourself. It would be no different than if the defendant were involved in civil litigation and was going to be deposed and needed advice whether or not to respond to questions during that civil litigation.
Right, and quite frankly, I think it would be ineffective for the criminal attorney, the OPD attorney, to pretend that the civil forfeiture is not happening and not provide some type of advice as to how that particular defendant's actions in that matter are going to affect his criminal case.
But isn't the problem that in many of these cases, especially coming out of the prosecutor's office, that one hand doesn't know what the other hand is doing, that there's a civil component, and that they're following up on the forfeiture, and they have no idea that there's a criminal side to this case?
Well, beyond the fact that we recognize that the actions of one prosecutor and the knowledge of one is imputed on the other and their actions of their office are imputed upon them, I think that going back to what Justice Fernandez-Vina said, this is a 90-day window for them to file.
Right.
The chances of, in 90 days, the criminal case being over is quite slim, quite frankly. They already know that, the prosecutors know that this is likely a case that's still pending. This is a seizure that's coming directly from that criminal case. I think if they're putting up a wall in their office, that's inappropriate. They should be cross-checking these matters to ensure that these defendants are, their criminal attorneys are provided knowledge of this action and that they're not put in a situation where they're forced to make a incriminating statement just to assert their due process rights.
Can I ask you a reality check question?
Sure.
Does the state, in almost every case in which one of these civil forfeiture cases is going to proceed, move for a stay, because they don't want discovery being used against the state during the course of the case?
Right.
So don't they, and the state will respond to this, if the case seems to be proceeding, do they routinely move for stays?
I'm not aware if they do. In this particular case, they waited until after the answer came in to move for
a
stay.
I mean, at some point. They
may at some point. I think the prosecutor might be a little more knowledgeable on that point. They have the ability to do so under the statute, surely. I just wanted to go back to Justice Timpone's question. Another thing with regards to the wall that's being put up, it's really not a wall, it's a screen, because the second the defendant filed his answer here, it got into the hands of the criminal trial prosecutor. So to say that they're two different units doing two different things, I don't think that's proper. They should be cross-checking each other, definitely, at the prosecutor's office when they're filing these civil forfeiture complaints.
But if I understand you correctly, your position is that the appropriate warning on the summons solves the problem.
I think it's a two-step solution, Your Honor. The appropriate warning on the summons still doesn't solve the problem of the choice that Mr. Melendez was given here, which is say nothing and lose your property, or say something and you now have incriminated yourself in the criminal case. I think the solution is not only the warning, but also to only use this for impeachment purposes, the answer that it can't be admitted as substantive evidence of guilt.
Okay. Anything you'd like to add?
No, Your Honors. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Shalom.
May it please the Court. I'd like to talk a little bit about the context of civil asset forfeiture complaints, a little bit about the constitutional argument, and then finally about the remedy. On the question of context, Justice Albin, I think it really informs the last question you ask, which is, does the state typically move for a stay? 97% of civil asset forfeiture complaints go unanswered, go into default. So no, they don't, because they rely on that fact. So they're only dealing with they're creaming, right? They're only dealing with this very small subset of cases. And there's a reason that so few are answered.
Can I ask you a question?
Of course.
Many of these forfeitures are for cocaine, guns, and other types of things that no one's going to be
responding to. So we're talking
to.
Only about derivative contraband, not direct.
Is that the 97%?
No, the 97% is all.
Okay, so that involves the guns and...
It
and
does.
Everything else.
But we know that there's a huge number of defaults, and we know why also. Defendants are pro se, right? There's no right to counsel built into the Constitution. And indeed, the legal services organizations are don't take civil asset forfeiture cases. So we had at the ACLU until last month, for 2 years, a fellow dedicated to doing civil asset forfeiture work. And what she found, she's the author of this brief before this court, what she found was that when she appeared in cases, people got their stuff back. But when she didn't, because prosecutors were so unused to people actually fighting these cases. And I want to add one thing. It's in footnote 16 of the Appellate Division opinion, which is the Hudson County Prosecutor's Office had a practice, which I believe they've discontinued, but that made it even more likely that people wouldn't fight these cases. Because so if there's a $150 requirement of payment with your answer, and they've seized $140, you're not going to pay it. And what the Hudson County prosecutor did was they would aggregate all these small and disconnected cases. So this seizure from Hoboken, a different one from Jersey City, the only thing that they had in common was that they were seizures that happened in Hudson County. They would file them under one complaint to get them out of the special civil part and into the civil part, raising the cost of answering. So this should have been in the special civil part, right? $2,900 is below the $15,000 threshold. But Hudson County said, we're going to put these all together with other cases that have nothing to do with Mr. Melendez. So that's why these stays aren't so routinely exercised. And I think that context is important in this broader conversation. On the constitutional argument, Justice Alvin, you, I think, hit the question, which is if you must answer before giving a stay, and if we don't make any changes to what the answer must look like, if you take the strict dictates of the civil asset forfeiture statute and say you must answer and you must claim ownership, then we have a Garrity problem head on. And that is the position of the Hudson County Prosecutor's Office in their papers. The Attorney General takes a different position, recognizing that we're not allowed to trap defendants between a rock and a whirlpool, as in Garrity. They say it's not a whirlpool because there's the availability of the stay as set forth by the Appellate Division. The problem is that's not a rock and a whirlpool directly, but they misinform the defendant about his right. They don't tell him about his right to seek the stay. They misinform him about the obligation to answer, and they misinform him about the right to counsel. So it's a rock, and there's a whirlpool with a path around it, but they've blindfolded him and spun him around and said, good luck, find your way around it. That's not fair. That is, in fact, the very conflict we're talking about, even with the imposition of the stay. To the question of remedy. Let me actually just say this. If the Hudson County prosecutor is right that you must request a stay, then there's a Garrity problem. But even if the Attorney General and the Appellate Division are right, and that's the position we took, that there is a way to seek a stay prior to filing an answer, this is complicated stuff. This is stuff that seven justices of the Supreme Court are questioning, that the Appellate Division came up with a different answer on. We're now going to ask a bunch of pro se litigants to navigate this?
Can I ask you a question?
You can ask me whatever you want.
Warrant you aligned with the Hudson County Prosecutor's Office. That would give you your best remedy.
Because I think we win either way, Justice Alvin, but
the simplest way would be reading the statute, from your perspective, reading the statute to require the claimant to make an answer. That creates a Garrity problem.
Yes.
As a result of Garrity, then the response is not admissible. That's your clearest path. You don't want that?
Of course I want that, but I don't think the Appellate Division's interpretation is absurd, and I want to provide you a path to victory for Mr. Melendez and justice to New Jerseyans that doesn't require that interpretation. And I think there is a very clear one, which is why, if we can't quite figure out what answer needs to be filed, what do you need to say exactly? Justice Patterson, you had some thoughts. Justice Leveque, you had some thoughts. But we don't have unanimity. Why are we going to make someone jump through the pro forma hoop when we know when there's a parallel criminal case, every good lawyer is going to advise their client to request the stay? And Justice Fernandez-Vina, your point is well taken. In a lot of counties, this is done as a matter of course. And it's not an automatic stay. It's a presumptive stay. So the innocent owner can still come forward and say, hold on, don't wait, I need my car back. Though most of these seizures are about smaller amounts of money rather than cars.
Oh, there are some about houses, too.
There are, but they're very infrequent, Justice Fernandez-Vina. The report, which I cited, the 97%, really goes through. Most often, we're talking about penny-ante amounts of money, which is why claimants aren't coming after them.
But don't you still have to file an answer in order to request even a presumptive stay, Mr. Shalom? I don't know how a non-party gets a stay.
it's imposed by the court. The court can recognize.
But you need joinder of issue. You need an adversary, don't you?
Well, but here's the thing. The notice, we're not talking about in every case, right? The notice here wasn't given to Mr. Melendez's mother or brother or uncle or aunt. It was given to him. So they thought it was his stuff. Whenever they think that the property, which is the defendant in the case, I acknowledge that, but they're still giving notice to a claimant. And when the notice in the claimant is also being charged by the same prosecutor's office with a criminal case arising from the same seizure, it's pretty easy to find
that
nexus.
Was he the only one who received notice? Do you know?
I don't. It's my understanding, but I'll defer to the parties.
But I'm not trying to trap you, Mr. Shalom. I'm just trying to think conceptually about a lawsuit. I mean, here you have an action started by the state. You need another party to enter into the proceedings in order to get the court to, on motion, either presumptively or somehow on application, to stop it before it can hurt the criminal defendant in the criminal proceeding. So my questions keep coming back to a way in which, one, the answer is as limited as possible, and two, it has as little or no effect in the criminal proceeding as possible.
I'm not sure, and I'm not actually disagreeing with your premise, I'm just not sure I know that that's true, that there's not a mechanism whereby the court could, prior to someone appearing, say, I'm going to hold this in abeyance.
When you look at the court rule talking about a stay, it talks about a party asking for a stay. So how do we work around that?
So let me back up. I think the fairest reading of the civil asset forfeiture statute and the associated court rules is the exact one that the Hudson County prosecutor has put forward, which is, look, under these rules, we did everything right. The problem is, under these rules, we violate the Constitution. That's the Garrity problem. And so I think this court is going to be required to make changes either to the statute or the rule. And the changes you're going to make are going to be the ones consistent with, you know, principles of statutory construction mm-hmm. and judicial surgery that are most faithful to the underlying scheme.
Wait,
and to avoid the tension that you're worried about is created and Garrity recognizes.
Exactly.
Well, look, if you align yourself with the Hudson County Prosecutor's Office and Garrity is the governing law, then the answer has already been given to us, no? The response can't be used against you. That's what Garrity says, no?
It is true that that is the remedy from Garrity, but I don't think that's a remedy that is compelled by Garrity if you could fix the Garrity problem. So, for example, if what we said was we're going to wait on the IA complaint to investigate the ticket fixing in Garrity, that would also have been a remedy, right? The court could come up with a different remedy that obviates the Garrity problem.
No, if the statute compels the answer, and this is the questions that I think Justice Lebecki is saying, this is an in rem action. This isn't your typical civil action where you know who the defendant is. No one knows who the claimant is until the claimant makes the claim. That's, I think, one of the reasons why that statute is written as it's written.
And I think that hides a little bit too much behind the legal fiction, Justice Albin. I don't doubt that there are some cases where we don't know who the claimant is, but they knew who the claimant was here.
I'm looking at count 7 of the complaint, the one that relates to this case.
Yes.
And it seems as though the prosecutor's office has already made this linkage plain and simple. The following amount was seized from the defendant, and then it identifies him by name.
So there might be cases where we can't figure out who owns the REM, but here they did. They knew that this was his stuff, and they were going to charge him criminally and seek to forfeit it.
I understand that, but the first order of business is reading the statute. So is your reading the reading that the appellate division gives to the statute or the one that the Hudson County Prosecutor's
no,
Office?
I think a straight reading of the statute is the one of the Hudson County Prosecutor's adopted by the Office of the Public Defender.
Okay.
That creates, however, a constitutional problem. The doctrine of constitutional avoidance says, let's see if there's a way we can interpret this statute to avoid confronting that problem.
Does the judge have the right to sua sponte stay an in rem action prior to the appearance of a defendant?
So, Justice Patterson, that was what I was responding to Justice Lavecchia. My answer is, I don't know why not, but there may well be an answer.
Because it, obviously
the
party must seek. But the party But obviously the statute describes how the party must proceed to get a stay, but there may be reasons why judges stay actions that are not reliant on the positions
right.
of the parties.
So let me say two things. First of all, I am agreeing that the statute as written is a problem, which means this court may, they can either declare the statute unconstitutional, seems unlikely that that's the path you'll take, or engage in judicial surgery. So once we're having to tinker with the statute, that question of what triggers the stay, does it require an application from a party, or can it be done sua sponte, to my mind, does the least violence to the legislative intent, does the least violence to the orderly operation of the scheme. And there may you may come to the conclusion that there are other ways to do it. Critical to us is the fact that you figure out something that does something, and that you acknowledge the context in which this is all happening, which is that we have pro se litigants who are getting bad information in the summons at worst, but even if they get bad information, need to be told how to do this. If we find a mechanism for them to avoid the whirlpool through door B, we need to tell them how to walk around that whirlpool.
But how do they run into that problem if nothing used in the answer can be used against them in a criminal proceeding?
To be very clear, our proposal of a stay was because I did not think this court was going to be interested in going there. If you go there, it solves the problem.
I'm not saying we are. I'm just asking. PD suggested an answer. Summons plus can't use it substantively in the criminal proceeding.
That would solve all of the problems.
Without changing the statute. Without performing judicial surgery.
Right. But it is creating an exclusionary rule. So it's not doing nothing to the scheme set forth by the legislature because they didn't envision that. Again, I think the scheme set forth by Ms. Lasota, better notice and exclusion, would solve the problem completely. We proposed the presumptive stay as what we thought was a middle ground, a less invasive.
I get that. I'm just making sure that you're not on.
Does
your better notice argument include the obligation to give Miranda warnings in the notice and counsel them about securing counsel to advise them? I'm using counsel twice there in sentence. I apologize.
I understand. So I wouldn't call them Miranda warnings, but I think being told about the fact that it could be used against them, which is, I understand, an aspect of Miranda warnings, right? There isn't a right to counsel, mm-hmm. so it wouldn't follow Miranda perfectly.
You're not arguing that there's a Miranda obligation here. Are you?
You'll see in our brief, we do advance the Miranda point.
I'm pressing you on it because it is a vast expansion of Miranda.
I agree, and I think there are much easier ways to get this without, I don't think you need to get to Miranda. So either through exclusion or the presumptive stay, I think you can obviate the Miranda problem. But I do think if there's not a presumptive stay, if what we're saying is exclude, either way, I don't think it hurts to say, if you have a lawyer, talk to your lawyer. But let's not tell people, hey, go to 123 Main Street and talk to the lawyer there when we know the lawyer won't talk to them. That's beyond unhelpful.
So a gentle reminder that you may want that counsel.
Exactly. I don't think there's a harm in doing that.
Okay.
And so, Justice Patterson, very briefly to your point, I think the questions about conflict with the Office of the Public Defender and beyond the scope are total red herrings. If I was a public defender representing someone in New Jersey and the police from Pennsylvania came and said, hey, we'd like to talk to your client about his involvement in this gang murder, I'm not licensed in Pennsylvania.
Understand.
I'd still tell my client to shut up because of how it would impact
his... But this is a little bit different. I mean, this is really directing somebody on how to proceed. And you have to in order to give the advice.
But the advice would be don't make incriminating statements, the same advice I would give them if they were...
In another criminal matter. Right,
and the Office of the Public Defender's charge is also limited to New Jersey, but they would still, I think, it would be their ethical obligation to give their clients good advice.
I'm simply saying, my concern is that would we put lawyers in a difficult position as to the client expecting them to provide some sort of guidance with respect to a civil proceeding?
That's a totally fair point, and I think the lawyers of the Office of the Public Defender are sufficiently skilled to draw the line and say, listen, I don't represent you on this, but let me tell you, if you tell them you own the money, then it's going to hurt you in the criminal case. That's I agree, something they'll have to navigate, but something they're certainly capable of doing.
Other questions? Anything you'd like?
No, thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Elson.
May it please the court. I'm going to throw a little bit more of a monkey wrench into the system here. In the more than a little bit of a year since the appellate division's opinion and the filing of the state's cross-petition, we have continued to evaluate the language and the procedure set forth in the civil forfeiture statute, specifically referencing 2C:64-3F. We have consulted not only with civil forfeiture prosecutors, but with the Attorney General's office. And as a result of our continuing analysis, the state agrees now with the finding of the appellate division and argues now what we had argued before the appellate division and ultimately before the trial court, that subsection F, when read in conjunction with the statute as a whole, is read to permit the filing of a request for a stay independent of the filing of an answer. The state agrees with the appellate division's finding that there was no violation of Mr. Melendez's Fifth or Sixth Amendment rights, that ultimately the procedural structure that the appellate division set forth as a result of their fundamental fairness analysis has generated a workable system through which the civil forfeiture claimants who are also criminal defendants are receiving proper notice with regard to the proceedings and permit the state to continue to function through the civil forfeiture proceeding. Lastly, the state would submit that despite all of these findings in this particular case with Mr. Melendez, that the admission of the answer in the case in chief was harmless error, that there was sufficient evidence in the record to tie Mr. Melendez not only to the apartment but to the back bedroom, the money and drugs that were seized and assorted paraphernalia that were seized, and therefore it was not the answer that led the jury to the ultimate conclusion of guilt, but the rest of the evidence submitted tying him to all of that criminal activity, and therefore the conviction should stand.
Can you just clarify your position? You're aligned with the Attorney General now?
Correct.
And amplify what you were saying about civil forfeiture proceeding and proper notice being given. Just tease that out a little bit more, your view today.
Today, so post-Melendez, in the appellate division's opinion, what is now happening with regard to civil forfeiture, the state has formulated a notice that is sent out with every summons that is sent to not only now civil forfeiture claimants or defendants in this matter, as well as their the summonses are also now sent to counsel. But the notice that goes out advises these defendants of the information that the appellate division went through in their analysis at the end of the opinion. It advises the defendant that they can seek a stay. It advises the defendant that if they are to file an answer, the information contained in that answer can be used at a later time. So the notice has now been provided to these defendants with regard to the information that they would put in an answer, and it is going out now post-Melendez on all civil forfeiture matters. I can speak to that. In Hudson County, it's my understanding that that's happening across
the
state as well.
So what you're telling us is you're in compliance with the appellate division opinion, and are you recommending that we adopt the appellate division's remedy?
Yes, it's an appropriate workable remedy that has put forth notice to the defendants as well as allowed the processing of civil forfeiture complaints in a manageable method.
Do we have a copy of the notice in the record?
There is a copy attached, I do believe, as part of the Attorney General's appendix. There is a copy of the notice that is sent out with all of the...
Where? Can you give us a cite?
Yeah. And if not, we'll ask the AG.
It is attached as A4 to the Attorney General's brief. The title of the document is Notice to Defendants on Civil Forfeiture Actions.
Okay, just I want to be crystal clear. When you say you're aligned with the Attorney General on the first point, it's now your position that a defendant can file for a stay in lieu of filing an answer, the position that you took in your opposition to the petition for certification, but not the one you took in your supplemental brief?
It's the position that we took in front of the appellate division that the defendant can ask for a stay before filing an answer or without filing an answer, correct?
Okay, and just explain for me in simple language how you think we can get there.
I think the statute has to be read, all of the sections of the statute have to be read together as a whole. It's obvious that the statute recognized an issue with regard to criminal defendants, especially looking at subsection, the last subsection of the statute.
J.
Is it an individual a claimant under subsection F before he or she has asserted a claim?
I think in affording broad standing in these types of matters, as this New Jersey has afforded in other aspects, that yes, a person can be potentially, can identify themselves as a potential claimant in a matter, who has a parallel criminal matter, to be able to seek the stay from the civil court, acknowledging that there is a parallel criminal matter.
Come back to my question, just walk me through your analysis under the statute and our understanding of who can seek stays in actions before a court that allows an interpretation that you're suggesting, that this claimant need not file an answer in order to request the court to enter a stay.
Well, it specifically referenced a defendant in a criminal proceeding arising out of the seizure.
What are you pointing at?
That's in subsection F, the second sentence talks about upon application of the state or claimant, if he be a defendant in a criminal proceeding arising out of the seizure, the court may stay the proceedings in the forfeiture action. And I think if you have a defendant who is obviously has the parallel criminal civil matter, if he requests of the court, it can be.
But how do you come to that reading under F as defining the criminal defendant as the claimant without looking back to subsection D that talks about the claimant of the property that's the subject of an action under this chapter being required to file and serve his claim in the form of an answer?
I look at D as advising the form in which the claim must come through, that advising that if the claim is made, that it has to be made in the form of an answer. The answer has to be verified on oath or affirmation, state the interest in the property, so it designates the form in which that answer must take.
How can one be a claimant if he hasn't claimed the property yet by filing an answer?
I'm sorry.
How can one be a claimant under F if he hasn't filed an answer seeking return of the property and claimed the property?
Well, I think that goes back to the conversation that was had when Mr. Shalom was arguing with regard to in a majority of these cases, we know where this often money is seized from and as a result of
the... So you've claimed it by way of answer. You're not a claimant. You have to claim it in order to become a claimant to seek the estate under subsection F. And the only way you can be a claimant, the way I read D, is to file an answer saying, I claim the property.
They could be identified by virtue of the fact that there is this parallel matter, and the court is aware of that situation.
Well, D helps you with that, doesn't it? Because D suggests that the claimant of the property shall file and serve an answer at least... In one interpretation of that would be the individual has status as claimant before he or she serves and files the answer.
Correct.
So D does suggest that claimant is not necessarily reliant on the previous filing of an answer.
But this is totally contrary to the argument that you made to the appellate division, correct?
We argued to the appellate division that the defendant could make a stay. Could request a stay.
No, but your argument was that he had to file an answer. Tell me if I'm mistaken about that.
In front of the appellate division, the argument was that the defendant could have sought a stay without necessarily filing an answer.
Listen to my question. under your interpretation of the statute before the appellate division, was it your position that the statute dictated that he had to file an answer? And did you cross-petition this court on that? I have your cross-petition before me right now.
Correct.
Criminal code, the rules of court dictate that an answer must be filed prior to the imposition of a stay in civil forfeiture proceedings. That's the issue that you asked us to take, correct?
Correct. That was the
and are you and are you now making a completely different argument before us?
We're making the argument that we made before the appellate division in the trial court.
You were at the appellate division. You were saying the answer need not be filed.
Correct.
That for the stay.
That the defendant could seek a stay prior to.
Before us, you argue the opposite.
Right.
And now you're back to your original
position.
Now you're
flipping.
Okay. That's keeping us awake.
Some of us.
Do you agree that if the statute requires the claimant to file an answer and to make a claim of the property, that would trigger Garrity, and if Garrity is triggered, then the response would be inadmissible?
Yes.
Okay. So by taking a position different from the one that you asked us the cross petition on, you move yourself out of that dilemma, correct?
Yes. However, as I indicated before, it was this. We're making the same argument now that we made before the appellate division and the trial court.
Have you looked at the answer that was filed in the companion case today, Colville?
I'm vaguely familiar with Colville, but I do not know the specifics of the answer that was filed. I understand it was a general answer filed by counsel.
You earlier in your presentation spoke about presenting as a potential claimant, and that's what happened in Colville.
Correct.
And you believe that's a satisfactory way to submit an answer as well?
That is, yes, that is one method that can be used and could have been used by any civil forfeiture claimant / defendant at the time prior to the opinion in Melendez by the appellate division. There was always the option to file sort of a general answer with a general denial that does not make any implication with regard to the property.
A general denial, in a negligence action, you could generally deny all the allegations. Obviously, that would run into some problems with the court rules. But here, the nature of an in rem action is really different, isn't it? Because there are allegations or factual allegations being made, and the remedy sought is forfeiture. That if someone comes in as out of nowhere and says I'm the claimant, how does a general denial even work there? They're denying what the state has to say.
I think this is where going forward in terms of what is submitted, the paperwork that is often used is sort of the forms that are generated by court rule. Mm-hmm. There's a form that's in the appendix to the court rule that's the general form that a lot of pro se defendants would use. So the state would suggest that there can be sort of either a separate form or an amendment to those forms that permit a civil forfeiture defendant to identify themselves, or with a parallel criminal matter, to identify themselves as a potential claimant. I'm aware that this has been filed. I have that sort of signals to the court. I'm aware that this has been filed. I have a parallel civil matter or a parallel criminal matter.
That sounds really complicated. And with regard to Justice Patterson's question, this is an in rem, okay? So the property is named, not the defendant. As Justice Patterson is suggesting, when the defendant is named in a complaint, a general denial is very easy. We know who the defendant is. You can't have a general denial when there's just property listed on the complaint. Like, what would that mean? A general denial can only make sense after someone is considered a party to the action. And under the statute, you don't become a party until you make a notice of claim. Am I mistaken? Am I missing something here?
No, but as has been mentioned before, we're not, oftentimes, in a majority of these instances, it's not questioned where or how this property has been seized. So it would not be an issue for a defendant to say, this property was seized in conjunction with my criminal matter, and therefore I am a potential claimant on this without having to make
but
any...
You know from all of these cases that many times, in many of these drug cases, the parent's car is taken, and you move to seize it, right? The parent has to make some sort of claim. Someone who owns that car has to come forward and say, that's my car, okay? And even if it was used in criminal activity, I didn't give permission.
And the parent would be able to do that.
But the parent has to say, in a response, I'm a claimant, has to make a notice of claim. Otherwise, the parent is nowhere, because the only thing that's on the caption is the property. In re, the seizure of the Pontiac. That's many forfeiture cases are by the names of cars, correct?
Correct.
Someone's got to say, that's my car. The only way that you can do that is by filing a notice of claim, correct? Someone's got to make a claim. You can't have a general denial.
What can you deny? You have to say, it's my money. It's my car. It's my house. You have to say that. So you can't deny that it's, if you deny it's your car or your money, that's the end of it.
Which I think is why looking at the structure that the appellate division set forth, it resolves many of these issues in allowing a party to, in terms of engaging in, as was mentioned before, judicial surgery, allowing a claimant to, or a potential claimant, to seek a stay on a matter when there is this parallel criminal matter resolves the issue.
Wouldn't it be simpler when in a case like this, where you've put out for the world in your complaint, this is the money that was seized from the defendant, to just presumptively stay the action?
I know in our county we seek stays on these types of matters. At this point. However, would that solve some of the issues? Yes. It would be more appropriate, as Your Honor has suggested, for it to be a presumptive stay rather than an automatic stay. There may, for any reason, be particular defendants who don't want to stay. That's obviously up to them.
Do these cases go to trial? How common is it, if a matter is challenged, that the state proceeds with the civil forfeiture action before the criminal trial and exposes its witnesses to cross-examination?
I would say it's very rare, if at all, that it proceeds in that manner. Often,
so if we,
I would say a vast majority, if not all of the cases, the criminal matter is resolved first and then the civil matter is resolved.
So the state wouldn't appear to be harmed by the imposition of a stay. In fact, it would get the benefit of this presumption that Section J provides after a criminal case might be resolved.
Correct.
Yeah? And on the flip side, the unwary defendant doesn't fall into a morass that he or she is unaware of.
Correct.
But why wouldn't it make sense to preserve for the innocent third party the ability to come in, but to stay these actions as against defendants in cases like this?
Again, assuming that it permits a defendant, for whatever reason, if he or she does not want the stay to be able to proceed, then there shouldn't be an issue. Beyond the fact that, just in terms of the volume of them, may cause issue in terms of administration through the special civil part.
Are you going to really want a presumptive stay if Mrs. Shalom is right? In the vast majority of these cases, no one's going to be contesting the money that was found right next to the cocaine. No one's going to be requesting that back. It may be the odd case where someone's requesting the money back. And the guns and all the other contraband, a presumptive stay for all of that, how is that going to be advancing the state's interests?
Well, and that also links back to what I just mentioned in terms of the sort of judicial economy through the special civil part if they're all granted, especially knowing that there are large numbers that go into default because no one ever, even after the criminal matters are resolved, puts any claim to certain property. It will create that landslide
backlog.
And
civil judges live by backlog.
Yes, and it will probably be a significant backlog with regard to the number of filings.
Most of these cases, I take it, are resolved by default, correct?
A vast majority of them, yes, is my understanding.
Anything else you'd like to present?
Nothing.
Thank you. Ms. Dominguez.
May it please the court. The Attorney General agrees with the Appellate Division's reading of the statute. That is, the state or the claimant, if he is a defendant in a parallel criminal proceeding, may apply for a stay pending the resolution of the criminal proceeding. We do not read the plain language to require that the defendant first file an answer before he can seek a stay. The preceding sentence in subsection F, that if an answer is filed, the matter be set down for a hearing, we don't read that to be a condition precedent to the state provision. Rather, the state provision provides for a separate procedure for claimants who are also defendants in a parallel criminal case.
What does it require for someone to be a claimant under the statute?
That is outlined in subsection D of the statute. However, since Melendez, we have been providing the notice requirements, and what has been happening in these cases is now defendants, through counsel or even on their own, have been requesting stays by just acknowledging that they are potential claimants and that they have parallel criminal proceedings.
So do you read D as suggesting that a person could, before they even get involved with the forfeiture action, can have the status of a claimant simply because they may have a claim?
Yes. And we have complied with Melendez by providing these notices, which we have attached to our brief. It's AA4. The notice outlines that the consequences of making a statement, the fact that they can seek counsel, and that any statement may be used potentially in a criminal proceeding. And it also advises potential claimants that they may seek a stay instead of filing an answer. So we feel that the Appellate Division got it right here in terms of creating a fair procedure, notifying defendants of any potential consequences of making a statement in the civil forfeiture action.
If we look at Section J of the statute.
I'm sorry?
If you look at Section J of the statute.
Yes.
It provides that evidence of a conviction of a criminal offense may be used in the civil forfeiture proceeding.
Yes.
The fact that there's no companion provision that says it may be used the other way, does that suggest that it shouldn't be, the statute prohibits the use in a civil forfeiture proceeding? Because it's allowed, it's spelled out that you can use it in a civil proceeding, a criminal conviction, but it doesn't have anything going the other way.
Right. However, we feel that if there's a fair procedure in place, notifying the potential claimant and defendant that a statement may be used in the criminal proceeding, there's nothing precluding the state from using that statement if the defendant, after receiving notice, decides to still make a statement. The legislature could have, as they did in Title IX or the domestic violence statute, included a provision deeming any statements made in the civil forfeiture proceeding to be inadmissible in a subsequent criminal proceeding. However, instead, they put in place the state provision, which is the procedural safeguard for potential claimants.
So you're also notifying defense attorneys?
Yes, we have been providing a copy to defense attorneys.
So after all these protections are put in place, it's only going to be when someone, the defense slips, some defendant makes some like awful mistake,
right,
and actually files an answer instead of filing the motion for a stay, correct?
Yes.
We're putting in all these safeguards just for that. Rather than just reading the statute in some plain way that's saying that the claimant has to make a claim, and if he makes a claim and an answer, it's just not admissible. What would be so terrible about that? His answer won't be admissible in the criminal case because that's what the U.S. Constitution demands if we read the statute in a sensible way.
But the legislature could have included a separate provision deeming these statements to be inadmissible in subsequent cases. Instead, they have provided for a stay, and that's the procedural safeguard in place for potential claimants facing parallel criminal proceedings. And we believe once there is a fair procedure in place, which we think the appellate division correctly put in place in Melendez, there's no reason why we shouldn't would be precluded from using a statement in the event that the
So let me give you a hypothetical. Money's found in a house. There are five residents in the house. The state sends out five notices to anyone who may have a potential. Mm-hmm. No one has to answer. Any one of those five people can just move to stay?
Well, the stay is only for potential claimants who are defendants in a parallel criminal proceeding.
Well, anyone may be incriminated. So even if the person isn't a defendant, the person could become a defendant by answering that, no?
But they could only apply for a stay if they are already a named defendant in the criminal proceeding.
And where do we get that? We just make that up?
It's in subsection F.
Where does it say that? The defendant in the criminal proceeding.
Upon application of the state or the claimant, if he be a defendant in a criminal proceeding arising out of the seizure, the Superior Court may stay the proceedings.
So your position is claimant for purposes of that is pre-answer as well as post-answer?
Yes.
And your position seems to give the same answer regardless of whether the civil forfeiture complaint is issued pre or post-indictment?
Yes.
Is there any legislative history to support your position that the legislature was aware of this potential use of the answer in the in-rem proceeding?
Not that we're aware of.
You accept the principle that forfeiture statutes like this should be strictly construed against the state, and that supports your argument as well?
Yes.
Anything else you'd like to add?
Just that we would ask this court to affirm the appellate division's decision in the case.
Thank you. Ms. Lasota, you have the last word.
Very briefly, and I didn't touch upon this in my opening argument, and I apologize. I want to talk about the harm to this particular defendant in this case. As I noted, this was his only statement admitting ownership to any of the evidence found in that room. The motion papers before the trial court are part of the record. In those motion papers, the state itself acknowledges the trial prosecutor that this was the most competent evidence linking Mr. Melendez to the evidence in that room. So this is not harmless error. This court has recognized several times that a defendant's own admissions, especially when they're taken in violation of the Constitution, rarely.
Well, what else was found in that room that linked the defendant to the room?
Handcuffs? Sure, but I would submit, Your Honors, that all that other evidence was stale, and I would submit, too, that just because something of a defendant's was found in a room.
The prescription bottles, they were stale too?
If you ask my father if some of my items are found in his house, he would say sure, but that doesn't mean I still live there anymore. That doesn't mean that I still own those.
He said he lived there with respect to the questions that he was asked during the booking.
Well, there was cross-examination as to whether or not those words actually came from his mouth or whether just the information from the search warrant was used. Also, there was evidence presented that just months prior he had provided police with a different address. So there was evidence that contradicted that. Removing the statement, I think there was fair inference here that the jurors could have not been satisfied that there was an actual link between Mr. Melendez and that room. The statement unequivocally tip the scales in favor of guilt, and it's not harmless error here.
Thank you.
Thank you.